This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. How will you remember 2021? It was the year of the vaccine, the year of the insurrection, the year of American troops leaving Afghanistan, a year of worker strikes, deadly storms, televised courtroom verdicts, cryptomania, supply chain meltdowns, culture war spats, big public funding bills, and Omicron. More people died from COVID-19 this year than last. It's been a year of hope and anger and loss. In 2021, we at On the Media focused on the narratives, the ideas and beliefs that shape the news, more than the specific characters that deliver it. But as a whole, it's been a hard year for journalists. We asked our reporter, Micah Loewinger, to take stock of who and what the press lost this year. Micah, welcome.
Hey, Brooke.
Where should we begin?
I wanted to start with the story of a journalist named Danish Siddiqui. He's an Indian photojournalist with Reuters. Mm-hmm. His photos of violence in Hong Kong, Kashmir, Afghanistan, Iraq are at this point iconic. He actually won the Pulitzer Prize for feature photography in 2018 for his coverage of the Rohingya refugee crisis.
Yeah, I remember one of those pictures, an exhausted refugee touching the shore after crossing the border by boat. It's indescribably moving and indescribably beautiful.
Like so many of his photographs, it captures place, character, politics, pain, hope. You can't see the woman's face, but yet you seem to feel her.
Siddiqui was killed in July. He was embedded with Afghan forces when the soldiers were attacked by the Taliban.
He was injured by shrapnel, brought to a mosque for medical attention, and while he was there, the Taliban learned that there was a foreign journalist in the area. They found him there. They identified him as a Reuters reporter. They kidnapped him. They murdered him, and the Taliban released photos of his mutilated body, obviously to make a point, to other media, to other governments, that if you come here, this is what we'll do to you.
Siddiqui, he was a special journalist, but he was also sort of a special case. He was a reporter for a major international news outlet. He entered the war zone on a dangerous assignment. That's not really the case for the majority of the 24 journalists who were murdered this year.
Yeah, when I was going through the list, I didn't recognize their names and I didn't recognize the outlets that they worked for. When I spoke to Robert Mahoney, who's the deputy executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists, CPJ, he said that most of these reporters worked for very small outlets doing hyper-local coverage, often without the protection that comes with bigger outlets, without the training. He told me the story of a Mexican journalist named Gustavo Sanchez Cabrera,
who was working in a small town in Oaxaca State in the south of Mexico. This man ran a very small news service reporting on corruption, local killings, local protests. He upset some very powerful local people.
Last year, during the summer, he had been shot in an attempted assassination.
But he continued to report because he believed in what he was doing was serving his local community.
The Mexican government actually has a program where they offer protection to people like him, targets of political violence. That protection never came. And then this summer...
Now he's riding on a motorcycle with his 15-year-old son when two men ram into the motorcycle. They then walk up and fire something like 15 bullets into him in front of his son. And his case is typical of so many local journalists around the world who are threatened but continue to do their work. Then they pay the ultimate price.
Tell me his name again, the name of this local reporter in Oaxaca.
Gustavo Sanchez Cabrera.
We also saw a record-breaking number of arrests of journalists. One case that got a lot of press was the Belarusian journalist Roman Petrusevich.
There's been a chorus of condemnation across Europe tonight after a Ryanair plane flying from Greece to Lithuania was diverted to Minsk in Belarus, and a dissident Belarusian journalist on board was detained. State media in Belarus said the plane was forced to land because of a bomb scare.
A Belarusian warplane, armed to the teeth, was dispatched to escort the aircraft in. But no bombs were found on board.
Dissident Roman Protasevich was paraded on pro-government TV, confessing to organizing mass riots.
The journalist's father said he believes his son has been beaten and his nose broken, disguised by makeup in the video, after that unprecedented hijacking.
293 journalists behind bars now. So tell me about a few of the others who were targeted this year.
Jimmy Lai.
Jimmy Lai, the owner of what used to be Hong Kong's most prominent pro-democracy newspaper, has been sentenced to another 13 months in jail following his conviction
for organizing a 2020 vigil commemorating the Tiananmen Square massacre. Critics say the charges are part of a crackdown on dissent.
For years, Hong Kong has been kind of like an island of media freedom. But last year, Beijing started cracking down on civil society in Hong Kong. China, for years, has been a prolific jailer of journalists, and this year they earned the top spot as the most aggressive jailer in the world. They also targeted a group of journalists who brought us the earliest coverage of coronavirus at a time way back when there was this mysterious flu or something in Wuhan. It really wasn't clear because there was such a tremendous media blackout. And one woman named Jiang Zhen,
she managed to get in and she started reporting on what was going on in the city, getting it out on social media and other platforms.
Robert Mahoney from CPJ.
In May of last year, she was brutally detained and charged with this really serious charge that the Chinese can bring against journalists called picking quarrels and provoking trouble. Could you imagine how many New Yorkers would be arrested if you could criminally prosecute people for picking quarrels and provoking trouble? She went on hunger strike, and then she was force-fed, trying to protest the fact that she was jailed for trying to tell the world what was going on with a global story.
This arrest rate, it's high, isn't it?
In the 40 years that CPJ has been collecting this data, they've never seen a number this high, almost 300 people. And I asked Robert Mahoney what accounted for this rise, and he said basically authoritarianism is coming back.
More and more governments want to stifle criticism. They want to shut down investigations into corruption and wrongdoing. Putting journalists in jail sends a message to other journalists that the same fate await them. And that brings about the cancer on journalism, which is self-censorship. Journalists don't report on subjects that they believe will get them arrested, jailed, even murdered.
So how about the American press? What are the trends in loss this year?
This year, we lost the Trump bump, which is
bit of a double-edged sword, eh?
Yeah. The truth about the last 4 years is that Trump's open aggression on the American press was pretty frightening and disturbing. But it was also a really profitable time for basically all American media.
It made supporting the press a political act, an act of engagement.
Slate did kind of a roundup. They found that the New York Times doubled their subscriptions. The Washington Post tripled their subscriptions. Even our listens and donations at On the Media ballooned, right?
They did.
I emailed two media reporters at Axios, Neil Rothschild and Sarah Fisher, trying to quantify what the loss of the Trump bump looks like. In the first 6 months of 2021, mainstream outlets, New York Times, Washington Post, USA Today, they lost about 18.3% monthly traffic on average. Move to the right-leaning, left-leaning, and then more partisan outlets, you actually see a harder hit. For instance, outlets like Mother Jones lost around 42% of its traffic. Far-right outlets like Newsmax lost 43.8% of their traffic. Fox News viewership seemed to drop by over 20%. So seeing this universal hit to the news media feels like a kind of foreshadowing for the type of coverage we might see again when Trump, I think, inevitably runs for office in 2024.
Well, we don't know that.
I mean, come on. You know, it's like pretty odd. It seems.
I don't think we know that, Micah.
Fair enough.
We'll see. The Trump years, though, did fill the coffers of the national news outlets. It was a much bleaker picture, though, for local outlets.
This is just the latest in a decades-long trend, but it's all been exacerbated by COVID. The Poynter Institute, which tracks the media industry, has counted dozens of newspaper closures over the past couple years. And among the ones that have closed this year, there's the McGregor Mirror, a Texas family-owned newspaper that's been around for over 100 years. Closed 2 months ago. The Kokomo Perspective, it's an Indiana newspaper that shut down last month, and an alt-weekly called Style Weekly in Richmond, Virginia, a 40-year-old newspaper, shut down last month. And this is an interesting one because it was owned by Alden Global Capital.
No, I'm sorry, but we've followed Alden. It's a scourge. It bought the Tribune Publishing Company. It's a hedge fund. That's the very definition of vulture capitalism. How many people were cut from Tribune Publishing after Alden bought it for over $600 million?
They cut 250 people. So they'll cut the staff, reduce operating costs, sell off the assets, like the building the newspaper operates out of. And then they drive up the subscription prices. For a little while, you can basically trick subscribers into paying more for a crappier newspaper until the whole thing collapses. And a once beloved newspaper is destroyed and Alden Global Capital is a little bit richer.
And in the past 15 years, more than a quarter of American newspapers have gone out of business.
And the ones that remain, about 50% of them are owned by financial firms like Alden Global Capital.
Okay, so now the question that we always have to ask on a show as meta as ours, why should we care?
Fewer people run for mayor in counties and in communities where a newspaper has shut down. Fewer people vote. A recent study published this summer from UC San Diego and Harvard found that newspaper closures are linked to higher rates of corporate corruption.
There are studies that have shown that political corruption, too, I mean, it seems obvious, goes up. And that frequently, this kind of corruption happens in plain sight because people aren't covering the public meetings or the state house sessions where it takes place.
And even just kind of like squishier social stuff, like obituaries, scores from high school sports games, job postings.
You're talking about the social glue.
The social glue that newspapers provide. When newspapers leave a community, where do people go to find that information? They either won't find it, or I think they seek out next door or local Facebook groups. And even coming from somebody like me who loves internet forums and has a sort of romantic idea of what online communities can achieve, I mean, local Facebook groups are toxic. They're filled with misinformation. They are not substitutes for real local reporting.
So the press has lost a lot this year. The lives of journalists, a loss of reporting due to self-censorship and imprisonment, the Trump bump, and the continued death of local news. So, Micah, as we greet the new year, what have we gained, if anything?
one thing we've definitely gained is a sense of solidarity.
How so?
Some data suggests that 2021 has seen the most new media unions in recent history. The New Yorker, Insider, iHeartMedia, The New York Times, public radio stations all across the country, journalists are forming unions to pressure their employers to offer better benefits, higher salaries, to address abusive managers and toxic workplaces. Even as our industry is kind of like falling apart, people are finding agency. And this isn't just some kind of inside baseball thing. I actually spoke to a professor at the University of Toronto, Nicole Cohen, who wrote a book called New Media Unions Organizing Digital Journalists. And she made an important point. Media unions are good for news consumers as well. And it makes sense. If you are working on some investigative project that takes months, if you're worrying the whole time about what your next gig is, or you don't have health insurance, or underpaid and working a part-time job, your muckraking is going to suffer, right?
You know, it's funny. That is maybe something we can take away from the Trump years and the pandemic years. They've increased some of the divisions among us, certainly. We've talked about those yawning chasms at length. But they've also brought groups of disparate people together. I mean, more people consider themselves workers now in the old union sense of the word. And they realize that things don't have to stay the way they were. It happens across the board.
And one other thing we've gained this year as journalists have started to have more open conversations with one another about the forces that threaten our industry, but also the forces that threaten the future of our democracy, is a sense of urgency. And I think we've lost some naivete.
With civil rights, voting rights, women's health care rights under attack, I think that the media has gained some awareness that democracy and human rights are actively being eroded at home.
This is Karen Atiyah, an editor at the opinion section at the Washington Post. And when I emailed her and asked her, what have we gained and lost this year, she sent me this voice memo.
And that the voices of Black, Latino women that have been warning us for years about America's dark domestic forces were right. So I hope that we lose for next year the pretense that both sidesism and neutrality will save us in the face of what's happening, because our very democracy is at stake.
You know, I don't like to end on tape, Micah, but just this once, I think I will.
Thank you.
Micah Loewinger is On the Media's reporter. Coming up, the myths and misdirection served up by true crime. This is On the Media.